ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The trend toward voting for minor parties has seen a sharp increase in Australia in the past few decades. And in the rolling hills of the Riverina region in southern New South Wales, there's a growing sentiment that the major parties don't represent the views of communities.
The landscape's changing and things are getting different. People are having different ideas that, if they seem to be the ones at an election that resonate the most with me and seem to align with what my ideals are, then I can't see why I wouldn't go down that route.
We'll look at the increase in minor parties later on in the show and the heartache of finding suitable social housing in Northern Australia.
It's precious. It's essential. And me and my children, we don't have our own little space. We don't have a safe place to put our head down at night. I've been couch surfing, going from family house to family house. Some family members are better than others. I can't even get housed. Like, we're left vulnerable and we're left exposed.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. To Northern Australia, to the ongoing controversy over the use of bill-paying service CentrePay by retailers for people on welfare. CentrePay is a government-administered financial tool designed to help people on Centrelink pay for essentials like rent or bills. Outback retailer Urban Rampage was ordered by the national corporate regulator, ASIC, to stop using CentrePay for selling goods in store. The company, which operates 10 stores across Northern Australia, has now withdrawn its appeal of that decision. But as Kimberley reporter Essie Deaves reports, their concerns Outback retailers will look to sell goods with other debit services.
It's been almost 2 years since the Australian Securities and Investments Commission issued a stop order on Coral Coast distributors' Urban Rampage stores, banning it from signing customers up to CentrePay. The retail chain operates 5 stores across WA, 4 in the NT and 1 in Queensland, and sells clothing, homewares and household goods, marketing itself online as an Australian-owned company which stocks the basics, supports the bush and stands proud in the places others forgot. The watchdog banned Coral Coast distributors from using CentrePay in February last year, saying the company was signing vulnerable customers, predominantly First Nations people, to the Services Australia scheme, leaving them at risk of financial hardship. ASIC Commissioner Alan Kirkland said the arrangement caused harm.
Well, people were buying household goods and those goods were being repaid through deductions via CentrePay. So that effectively meant that deductions were coming out of their Centrelink payments before they even received them. Now, these were by definition people on low incomes. So when those incomes were cut even further, that meant that many of them were unable to pay day-to-day expenses, such as paying their grocery bills. So it was creating serious financial harm.
CCD appealed the ban, which was set to be heard before the Administrative Review Tribunal, but has since withdrawn the application. The case has been finalised and the ban stays, coinciding with recent reforms made by the federal government to the CentrePay scheme, which came into effect on November the 3rd. The changes mean items such as household goods, sports equipment and furniture could no longer be purchased using the credit tool.
We know that regardless of our stop order, reforms are coming through in the CentrePay system that actually mean that Urban Rampage would no longer be able to use CentrePay to sell household goods. So the writing was on the wall, but we're really pleased that they've discontinued this appeal because we made that stop order for a reason we think should stand, and now we know that it will.
ASIC says it's unclear how many customers were signed up to debts they could not afford or fully understand. Coral Coast distributors declined an interview but responded to our questions by email. When asked if the choice to back down on its appeal meant the company was admitting to causing financial harm, a spokesperson said no. The company said the ban was issued without any evidence of customer complaints, customer harm or unconscionable conduct, and says it has never failed a Services Australia audit and always complied with all relevant laws and regulations. CCD said it withdrew its appeal because the recent CentrePay changes ensured a fair and level playing field for all businesses operating in the same household goods category. While CenterPay is off the cards for Urban Rampage, the company is allowed to sell goods through another direct debit program and Afterpay. CCD said it was confident in these processes, with customers individually assessed by trained staff. In the meantime, Jadigent financial counsellor Veronica Johnson said these arrangements must be monitored carefully.
And I think this just opens up another can of worms. And my firm belief is you turn off one tap, and then another one opens. And I think if any direct debits are going to be done by any organisation, that an affordability check should be made. But now it's just giving them free rein to do whatever they want with the most vulnerable people.
Kimberley reporter Essie Deves with that story.
ABC Australia Wide.
We'll stay in the north of the country and head now to Broome in WA's north, where housing availability is under pressure. A mother arriving at her new home in Broome, leased through Western Australia's housing department, says she was devastated by what she found. Photos shared with the ABC show the house strewn with rubbish and used needles, while the inside was caked in dirt. The department says the property was vandalised before the tenancy started and wasn't like that when it was inspected. Ruby Littler has this story.
Having experienced homelessness for years, single mother of two, Amelia Johnson, says she was relieved when she secured a house in WA's far north. But she says that relief quickly vanished when she visited the home assigned to her in October by the WA Department of Housing and Works in Broome.
Because it was dark, I couldn't see all the dirty needles everywhere until I got out of the car, and then I walked towards the house and through the driveway. It was just shocking too, dirty needles in a syringe. And then the further I walked, the more disgusted I became. Like, underneath all of that bushy garden, I can only imagine how many of these dirty needles are there, covered in leaves. And we've just moved into town. I was under the impression that we were going to have a better quality of life, a better education for them, better employment opportunities for me.
Ms. Johnson also claims the property was not secure, with large gaps between the screen doors and windows. She deemed the house too unsafe to live in with her 11 and 12-year-old children, so she returned to Kununurra, 1,000 kilometres away, to couch surf with relatives instead.
It's precious. It's essential. And me and my children, we don't have our own little space. We don't have a safe place to put our head down at night. I've been couch surfing, going from family house to family house. Some family members are better than others. I can't even get housed. Like, we're left vulnerable and we're left exposed. And the harder I try to get good accommodation for us, it's just next to impossible.
Ms. Johnson says she feels as though the government has failed and ignored her in a time of crisis. WA Council of Social Services CEO Louise Gelito says it's never acceptable to lease out a house if it's unlivable.
One of our key recommendations to state government in our recent state budget submission is to implement a proactive planned management maintenance program for public housing that is responsive to the needs of regional and remote communities. You have Grow Housing, which is for public servants, which has minimum standards that includes, you know, thermal controls, cooling, heating, fans, but they don't apply the same minimum standards for public housing. And we think and firmly believe they should be the same. Housing is a human right and minimum standards are really important.
Ms. Gelito says the Department of Housing and Works gets over 200,000 work orders for repair and maintenance annually. She said in the Kimberley and Pilbara, the problem was often getting the workforce to actually do those repairs.
And they're in a really tight position. So do they let the properties sit vacant or do they fill them? And depending on the state of the building, I think they're making value judgments about, you know, do they allow tenants to go in? Because there's such high demand, as we know. There's over 20,000 people on the wait list, so they're in a bind at the moment.
In a statement, a Department of Housing and Works spokesperson said in this case, in between an inspection and when Ms. Johnson moved in, people have broken into the property and significantly vandalised the property, and that this was not the condition of the property when it was offered to Ms. Johnson. The statement also said that such incidents can occur on the private rental market, and the department is in regular contact with Ms. Johnson, who has been offered another three-bedroom home in Broome.
Ruby Littler reporting from Broome in the Kimberley of Western Australia. Politics is the talk of the town today as we remember the constitutional crisis of 1975. But if we look at voting trends in Australia, there's been some big changes since then. The trend towards minor parties has seen a sharp increase in the past few decades. For example, in 1981, the primary vote for minor parties and independents in New South Wales was just 5%. 2 years ago, it was 28%. In the rolling hills of the Riverina region in southern New South Wales, a far cry from the bustle of big cities, there's a growing sentiment that the major parties don't represent the views of communities. This year, two new parties have applied to the New South Wales Electoral Commission for official registration, and One Nation has started its own branch. Andrew Mangelstoff takes a look at the changing political tide.
As wind sweeps over the dry dirt roads of Sam Ryan's cotton farm, the dust clouds tell a tale of drought and hardship. The Maramai farmer feels, unlike other natural disasters, the drought affecting southern parts of New South Wales isn't getting the political attention it deserves.
There's a lot of talk around the net zero and all that sort of stuff, but it seems like we don't have much representation when it comes to boots on the ground. It all seems to be just, you know, you might get the odd comment here or there, but ultimately the focus seems to be elsewhere at the moment. Communities are struggling and things with, you know, low water allocations, and we don't really get a great deal of representation where we need it.
He says it's for this reason that he'd consider supporting a micro party at the next state election.
I haven't exactly considered micro parties before. I have never really been so very informed about them, but yeah, I suppose the landscape's changing and things are getting different. People are having different ideas that, yeah, if they seem to be the ones at an election that resonate the most with me and seem to align with what my ideals are, then I can't see why I wouldn't go down that route.
The Riverina state has one purpose, and that is to form a whole new state, while the Rural Party, backed by the independent member for Murray, Helen Dalton, is more focused on rurally specific issues like water allocation. These narrow but relevant purposes resonate with Leeton business owner Rhonda McCormick.
Well, the big one is for here is water. It's also our farmers are doing it tough, and they're just, nobody seems to care about our food anymore. Small businesses are closing and electricity prices are too high, way too high. People can't afford to live anymore.
But this trend isn't just in the Riverina. According to Deakin University political scientist Zim Wokora, there's an increased fragmentation of politics on a national scale. He says the movement behind parties like the Riverina State Party appear to be fairly radical.
The Riverina State Party is advocating for a new state of the Commonwealth of Australia. I mean, that's a rather astonishing undertaking, right? I mean, that would require a constitutional change. It would require a political movement that hasn't been summoned in this country for a very long time. It would require a political moment that would seem to be basically well beyond anything that's discussed in the political mainstream.
Which is exactly the point. The idea of a Riverina state has been around for well over 100 years. David Landini hopes to finally pull it off. According to the party plan, the New South Wales and Victorian state borders would be redrawn, separating regional areas from the bigger metropolitan centres and giving power back to the bush.
The people in the Riverina have always been separated commercially, economically, and those two are very similar, but also culturally, from the population of Sydney, Newcastle, Sydney and Wollongong.
That's the founder of the Riverina State Party, Wakul Woolbroker David Landini. His concerns and reasons for dabbling in politics echo those of Murray MP Helen Dalton, who won't be joining the Rural Party but did back it. She hopes to use it to push her policies to portfolio ministers in the upper house.
We're the powerhouse for agriculture. All our wealth comes from the soil or the earth, whether it's mining or farming, and we need to be able to have our say. We need to be consulted properly and genuinely, and we haven't been for the last probably a dozen years at least.
While there's a political buzz on the ground in the Riverina, Dr. Wokora says major parties will continue to be able to form government in the lower house for some time, and the trend towards smaller parties is more advanced in the upper house.
She can endorse whoever she wants in the same way that she can vote for whoever she wants. I mean, typically it's quite possible for these minor parties to do quite well in the upper houses because you only need a small fraction of the total vote in order to win election. And then from there, you've got a platform to potentially shape legislation. You'll certainly have a platform to explain and voice your views. That's become clearly the way in which small parties have gained their slice of media attention and the way they've contributed to the public debate.
Political scientist Zim Wakara, ending that report from Andrew Mengelsdorf. The Great Artesian Basin is one of the largest underground reservoirs in the world, and it's a crucial water source for people in the outback. Graziers across western Queensland wanting to grow fodder crops to feed their livestock need reliable access to this water for irrigation. Now, to get a water licence is almost impossible, but now the plan that manages it is under review. Madeline McCosker has more.
Looking out across Scott Holcomb's sorghum crop, you'd be forgiven for thinking you were standing smack bang in the middle of southern Queensland's cropping country. But it's not. His 4,000-hectare dryland crop is in the heart of outback Queensland's cattle country, 1,400 kilometres northwest of Brisbane, near the small outpost town of Caulfield. This country is known for its wide Mitchell grass plains, variable seasonal conditions, and long, hard droughts. But Mr. Holcomb has been able to transform what he describes as his most unproductive country into his most abundant by growing sorghum. He's been growing the crop for about 7 years now to feed his cattle, and he'd like to expand it by accessing water from the Great Artesian Basin.
If we could get access to water from the Great Artesian Basin and put pivots and things like that in, that would be game-changing in a very positive direction.
The dryland sorghum relies on rainfall during the wet season from November to April to replenish soil moisture so it can survive during the dry season. Mr. Holcomb wants to be able to irrigate during the drier months, not just to expand the size of the crop, but to also improve its quality as its nutritional value declines without water.
To irrigate in the winter is the perfect time to do it because we don't have the huge evaporation in that time of year, opposed to the summer. Plus you're getting rain in the summer, so you know you don't really need it then.
Mr. Holcomb says it would not only be a game changer for him, but it could also advance the wider cropping industry across the West.
The hardest thing is getting the soil, and we've got the soil. You just have to add water. So, you know, what that would do for the towns would be astronomical.
The Great Artesian Basin holds about 65 million gigalitres of water underground, and for landholders to get even a drop of that, they need a licence. In Queensland, they're allocated and managed through the state government's water department. There's different types too. Stock and domestic licences are the most common, used by graziers to ensure their stock and homes have water. Department of Water Southern Region Executive Director Hamish Butler explains how it works for irrigation.
When it comes to water licences for other activities like irrigation, water licences cannot generally be granted. However, there are provisions in the water plan to trade water entitlements for irrigation purposes between landholders. It just allows water to move around in various areas towards the activities where people need it most.
In comparison, there's about 6,500 stock and domestic licences, but for irrigation, there's only 21. They also have a volumetric limit on them. The Great Artesian Basin and other regional aquifers water plan, also known as Gabora, that licences are granted through, is under review, with the new plan expected to come into effect from late 2027. As the cropping industry expands into new areas, Mr. Butler says interest in water allocations is growing.
We are seeing a need to open up that trading framework. The Gabora Water Plan is currently under review and is being replaced. And that part of that process, the department is going to look at the trading rules to see if they are appropriate or if more flexibility can be introduced. So all of those rules and regulations and the way that GAB is managed currently is really up for review. And that'll be part of the next sort of year to 2 years work we'll do with a whole range of technical studies, but also engagement with the community to understand and we might get the right balance there.
Back on Scott Holcomb's property, he says his stock are still putting on more weight from eating sorghum than they would had they been eating grass during the dry season.
We're in a sort of a weight gain business and we're summer rainfall and come around July, a lot of our weight gain has starts to run out. You know, it starts getting down around that 0.3, 0.4 sort of a game. And then when you get down to September, it's sort of right down around 0.2 if you're not assisting with feed supplements.
For Mr. Holcomb, having access to nutrient-rich sorghum year-round would certainly help push his business forward.
If you get a really good season, you know, you can grow sorghum 3 metres high and that thick, you can't walk into it. And when it doesn't rain, you don't grow anything.
Caulfield farmer and grazier Scott Holcomb, ending that story from Madeline McCusker. Letters written 109 years ago by two World War I soldiers have been reunited with their family members after they were found in a bottle on a remote beach in Western Australia. The bottle was discovered on Wharton Beach near Esperance last month and contained letters from two World War I soldiers on their way to Europe back in 1916. Reporter Katrina Tapp spoke with one of their grandchildren about what the discovery of the letter has meant for them.
Finding a message in a bottle is the sort of thing many beachgoers dream of. So when Deb Brown's daughter found one on their family's favourite beach near Esperance on WA's south coast, she couldn't quite believe it.
It was just in the shoreline where the little waves were lapping, in the shoreline. She brought it inside to me and said, "I've got you a present, Mum," and she gave it to me and we said, "Oh, wow, that's pretty cool, but I'm sure you won't be able to read anything on the letter because you could see that it was wet."
After removing the cork and allowing the bottle's contents to dry out, Miss Brown was able to gently take out one of the letters. It was from an Australian World War I soldier.
"I found a letter from Malcolm Alexander Neville asking the finder of the bottle to send the second page of his letter to his mother. So we thought, oh, wow, this is wonderful." So then I jumped on the computer and went on to the Australian War Memorial and found all his history and found that he had been killed in action exactly a year later in France, and he was 27 years of age.
After letting a second letter dry out for a few days, Miss Brown uncovered correspondence from another soldier, Private William Kirk Harley from Adelaide, who remarked in his letter that he was somewhere in the Bight. And unlike Private Neville, William survived the war, going on to have children and grandchildren.
"I have to say, the story of how this letter was found and recovered and then now returned to us is extraordinary in itself. And it's been absolutely astonishing to William's five surviving grandchildren who just can't get over this, and I must say regard it as some sort of a miracle."
Private Harley's granddaughter, Michelle Patterson, says the letter's arrival couldn't have been more serendipitous. At the same time, Private Harley's 14-year-old great-great-grandson was on his own boat trip in the Great Australian Bight.
"My brother, his grandson, who's aged 14, was on a school camp sailing in the Gulf down towards the Bight at the time the letter was, around the time the letter was actually found coming back to us. The particular trip he was on was a school camp that was no phone, no tech, so they were all encouraged to write letters. The result of this is my older brother, one of William's surviving grandchildren, received two letters from somewhere in the Bight in the same week. One from his grandson and one from his deceased grandfather, written 109 years apart.
But unlike his great-great-grandson, William Harley did not return from his boat journey unscathed. And sadly, his older brother did not return at all.
"Whilst William was able to return from the war despite having been shot in the back and also wounded a second time when he was gassed, he didn't survive for very long. William's older brother, Henry, had left for the war a few months before William. At the time that William threw the letter into the Bight, he was only a couple of days into his trip over to the war. Henry had been killed. And in the letter, what we can hear is that they were in very good spirits and they were telling everyone not to worry and that they hoped to be home soon when the business was all finished with."
Australian War Memorial curator Bryce Abraham says despite the horrors ahead of them, this kind of optimism for war was not uncommon.
We know at the outbreak of war there was that
enthusiasm to, you know, people to enlist to do their bit, and that the war was like a great adventure. It had started to wear off by 1916 because the casualty lists from Gallipoli were well known, but it hadn't disappeared entirely. For these men, it was, for most of them, it was their first time going overseas, so it was an adventure, it was hopeful.
Mr. Abraham says while Privates Neville and Harley would have been two of hundreds of men making the same journey, we don't know how many threw letters overboard.
We're not aware of that many letters in a bottle that have been recovered. So in the memorials collection, we know of three. It definitely occurred. It definitely was like an almost whimsical thing that they did.
For Michelle Patterson, the arrival of her grandfather's letter, albeit a century late, provides a connection she's looked for her whole life.
For me personally, William was the one person of all of our ancestors that we know about that I really, really, really always wanted to meet. This, for me, is very close to being able to meet him. We'll be forever grateful to the family in Western Australia, the Browns, who took such care with their find on the beach and have managed to track us down and give us such an important and historic part of our history back. It's wonderful.
It's pretty cool. That was Michelle Patterson ending that story from Katrina Tapp.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
It all began with a railway camp wagon and a water tank almost 30 years ago. A regional psychologist dreamed of a place veterans could visit when things were getting tough. Now at Coxcomb Veterans Bush Retreat, you'll find a sprawling property of sheds, cabins, a kitchen and a museum. Vanessa Jarrett headed along to find out the power of working bees and mateship.
It's a Tuesday morning, the busiest day of the week, at the Coxcomb Veterans Bush Retreat at Quarrel near Rockhampton. But between the jobs at a working bee, a group of mates sit around a table, enjoying a cup of coffee and homemade baked goods for morning tea.
It's a place where people can get together, but it's also a place where we have people that come here that do nothing but sit around and talk. You know, we have a table up there, we call it the table of knowledge. They sit there and just talk about things, and that's what the place is about.
Bob Holmes is the Coxcomb Volunteer Group president. He joined the Australian Army when he was 17 years old and fought in Malaya the following year. After his return home, he was deployed to Vietnam. He said for decades, he kept his experiences to himself.
I think probably for the first 25 years, I don't think anyone I worked with knew I was being to Vietnam. And I think that was the same with a lot of Vietnam vets. You didn't say anything about it. It's only later years that with everyone, you know, things start coming back, and that's why places like this were invented.
Coxcomb has more than 650 members from all over the country. While it is set up to cater for travellers with cabins and dongas, the standing weekly working bee is also an important part of the retreat. Ronald Robertson was a telegraphist specialising in Morse code in the Royal Australia Air Force. He has been coming here for 17 years.
Because you come up here, if you want to work, you can work. If you don't want to work, a couple of them just sit around and talk. Firstly, one day you're helping the carpenters, next day you're helping the plumbers, or you're down in the shed supervising them. Handyman work sort of thing. Most of the time you don't talk about your experiences. Sometimes you do if you... You know, blokes having a bit of a downer and have a bit of a chat, which is, you know, helps a lot.
Gary Semple used to bring his dad, who was ex-army, to Coxcomb for events with a local RSL group. Years later, he found he needed the support himself. Coxcomb isn't just for war vets, but also emergency service personnel. Gary spent almost 40 years with the Yeppoon Fire Station.
It doesn't take a real lot for people to become traumatised, suffer whatever they're told they're suffering from. In my case, it was a full 40 years or almost, and it sneaks up on you. But I do believe, you know, one or two incidents were probably enough to cause someone to suffer. Someone says they're suffering, I believe them, even though they might not have been to war or even just involved in first responding duties.
Chatting with his newfound mates helps lighten the black cloud.
We don't sit down and have big talking sessions about our dramas, but I think it's just you do gradually get rid of some of the incidents that end up bothering you.
Veterans retreats are dotted across Australia. Here at Coxcomb, local community groups from the Probus and Lions Club and the War Widows and RSL Auxiliaries also visit the property, browsing the latest edition
a museum filled with military memorabilia. The dream of helping those in need, made all the way back in 1997, is still well and truly alive.
They travel, a lot of them just travel from one veteran's retreat to another every year, especially in the summer, winter times when it's a bit too cold in Melbourne or Sydney. They all come up around this way, so hopefully it's made a difference to everyone that's come up here. But put a number on it, who would know? I mean, hopefully we've helped a lot of them.
Bob Holmes finishing that story from Vanessa Jarrett. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.